G20 meets P200,000 or so.
What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street.
In advance of the G20 summit to save global capitalism, protesters have a suggestion. End global capitalism. Leaders stay on message. Protesters try offing the message. For what it's worth, something's happening.
Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going
on. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, April the 1st. I'm firmly okay. Is that why I'm here? Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. So coming up this hour, we'll discuss President Obama's meetings today with world leaders ahead of the G20 summit. We'll also take a look at the state of Pakistan's government following the reinstatement of the Chief Justice. Well, those stories coming up, but first, the headlines.
Take a look on the streets of London. Bankers are wearing jeans to work. Casual Wednesday? No, it's to avoid being hounded by protesters. Thousands have gathered in the city to protest a number of issues linked to the G20 summit. We have a bit of this. We've been talking about the scene all morning. There are people all over the street. The protests have remained free of violence. So far, London police have upped security. President Obama is sticking with his suit during his full day of meetings with other world leaders. He just had one this past hour with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. They're expected to announce talks to limit the number of nuclear warheads. It'll be the first major arms control negotiation since 1997. Later today, the president will meet with Chinese President Hu Jintao. Femi?
So there's these big meetings between other world leaders as well. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is in Turkey today to meet with the Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari. And the talks are aimed at increasing cooperation between the countries in fighting militant violence. And there's actually been plenty of militant violence in both of those countries today. 12 people are dead after a suspected U.S. drone attack in Pakistan. It targeted the hideout of a Taliban leader, according to a senior intelligence official. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, at least 14 people are dead after a militant attack on a local government office in Kandahar.
Here in the U.S., adhesive manufacturer 3M announced today it's cutting 1,200 jobs, 1.5% of its workforce. Japanese automaker Honda planning to scale back its North American production. The Dow and S&P both went up more than 1% yesterday. The Dow kicks off today at 76.09. The S&P starts trading at 7.98. So you've seen on the streets protesters all over the city of London, which is the center of the financial district in that city. They're protesting the G20 summit and have messages for the capitalist nations of the world. They're bearing signs like capitalists, you are the crisis. You're not in London, but join the protest, won't you? Tell us what you would write on your sign. Give us your best at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I've got one.
We have one?
Yeah, I've got one. Anarchy, mission accomplished. Would that work?
Anarchy, mission anarchy. Try anarchy, won't you?
Yeah.
You know, anarchy, it's cheap.
Nowadays,
yeah.
It's cheap.
Well, there's 200,000 people on the streets. So far, the protests aren't violent, and there are meetings going on between the president and world leaders. U.S. president and the Chinese president, Hu Jintao, is expected later on this morning.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with our own Femi Oke, filling in for Adora Udoji. Behind closed doors, the world leaders, the leaders from the G20 nations are speaking, but on the streets of London, there's the sound of protesters. The police in London say they've been ready all day for this event.
I'm here to make sure that the city operates as a city, business as usual. With one or two adjustments, obviously, for people to protest quite lawfully. But if they overstep that mark and break the law, they'll be dealt with firmly. No ifs, no buts.
That's the City of London Police Commissioner Mike Barron. It is not business as usual, though, on the streets of London and here following the protests as the G20 leaders gather in London for an expected meeting tomorrow. We go to the BBC's Jack Izzard, a presenter for the BBC Today program. He's on the streets. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
So a lot more people than when we spoke with you a few hours ago, but any violence?
Well, so far, very little. There's been a fair bit of pushing and shoving. As you say, several thousand people now taking part in these demonstrations. There are two major demonstrations going on as we speak, both of them within a few hundred yards of each other here in the City of London, the financial district of the British capital. We've got two demonstrations. The first one is by anti-capitalists and anarchists. The second one is by an environmental group. Now, get this, they are doing what they call flash camping. They reckon it's a new type of demonstration. It's a bit like flash mobbing. They coordinated themselves through social networking sites like Twitter, through text messages. Within just a few minutes in the last hour, they all showed up. They all appeared at exactly the same time, at the same place. They started pitching tents right here on the street in the middle of the City of London. Their aim is to block off traffic, cause as much disruption as possible.
Jack, it's as though electronically using these tools, the protesters have their own helicopter from which to direct things over the heads of the police and law enforcement.
Well, they don't have their own helicopter. You can probably hear two helicopters over my head at the moment. One belongs to the media. It's beaming back live pictures of all the demonstrators gathered here on the streets. The other one belongs to the police. They're, of course, filming everything here. They will potentially be using that film as evidence if crimes are committed. Now, in terms of the police involvement, huge numbers of police officers out on the streets today and tomorrow. They are expecting sizable demonstrations both today and tomorrow during the summit proper. In terms of arrests so far, well, 11 protesters have been arrested for possessing police uniforms. And get this, this gives you an idea of how inventive some of the protesters have been. Earlier on, police officers stopped an armoured personnel carrier being driven by a group of protesters. They were all inside, dressed in overalls. The police arrested them. They checked out their driver's licences. Apparently they're all in order. They allow them to carry on driving, but they've managed to get themselves an armoured car. That gives you an idea of how much thought and preparation has gone into this demonstration on the part of the protesters. The police say they're ready to.
Now, Jack, I would have thought that with all this talk of an economic downturn with so many dire global implications, there would be more passion and raw anger on the streets. It seems much more symbolic and much more a set of mixed messages rather than one very passionate kind of hot coal of anger.
I think you're absolutely right in saying that the emotion there is genuine and it is raw. The message is mixed. The bottom line is we've got three large coalitions of hugely divergent groups. There are anarchists there, there are anti-capitalists, there are environmental campaigners, there are anti-war campaigners. And I think, as you say, the danger is that their individual messages may get drained out, get sort of drowned out in the cacophony of shouting that we're seeing. Now, as I say, mostly thus far, it has been shouting, a bit of pushing and shoving, but so far, very little signs of violence. But we expect these demonstrations to go on for a long time. This is just the beginning.
Well, let's tick off some of the messages. They may get lost in the noise of the helicopters, but they're not going to get lost on this program. What are the protest messages that you're seeing?
Well, as I said, two large coalitions demonstrating as we speak. The first one call themselves G20 Meltdown. Now, they're gathered outside the Bank of England right now. That's the financial heart of Britain, if you like. They accuse the bankers, the capitalists, of being the bad guys, if you like. They've called for an end to capitalism. They want to overthrow the capitalist system, no less. They want to set up a system of anarchy. And we've seen some pretty fiery rhetoric from them. There's been a guy with a loud hailer really winding up the passions of the crowd. He's called on them to hang the bankers. They're calling for a bonfire of bankers. Lots of, you know, spirited rhetoric, but so far it's mostly been talk. That's the anti-capitalists. What about the environmentalists? Well, they're the guys I talked about who have planned this flash camping demonstration. They put up tents. They hope to be camping there in the streets of London overnight, right up until tomorrow morning, when their ambition is to march east of here down to where the G20 leaders will be meeting for the summit in the morning. Frankly, I think it highly unlikely the police will let them demonstrate for that long. But for now, they are being tolerated. And the mood, frankly, pretty upbeat. We've heard lots of talk of carnival atmosphere. Certainly when I went down there a few minutes ago, there were drums playing, there was music. People really excited to be here. It's a rare sunny day here in the British capital, it must be said. So for now, the mood is light, the mood is upbeat. But a long way to go yet.
Well, Jack, and of course the irony is that unless they're near a television screen, the G20 leaders aren't even likely to get a glimpse of these protesters even tomorrow. BBC's Jack Izzardi reports for the BBC Today program, our partners in London. Thanks, Jack.
Pleasure.
Femi.
Thanks, John. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Hu Jintao meet for the first time today. So joining us on the line is Bill Emmett. He's the former editor of The Economist and the author of Rivals, How the Power Struggle Between China, India and Japan Will Shape Our Next Decade. So, Bill, how do you think the U.S. should respond to China's increasingly aggressive stance?
Well, I think that China is being aggressive because it feels a bit confident. Its economy is in trouble, but it's in less trouble than the U.S. or many of the European economies. Also, it feels that America's weak, that, okay, it's got a new president, but it's in a weak and vulnerable position. So China's got a chance to take some opportunities here. But it's not so strong that it wants to actually take over leadership. So I think the U.S. can respond respectfully, say it's willing to discuss China's requests, its proposals, its initiatives, but still stand firm and still be confident.
What do you think might possibly come out of today's meeting?
I think that out of today's meeting will, I hope, be a sort of a declaration of harmony, first. Secondly, a promise not to be protectionist against each other, not to restrict world trade, which is already collapsing. We don't need any barriers, particularly against Chinese exports or vice versa. And thirdly, I think an agreement to stay in close touch about economic stimulus programs later in the year, which is going to be the crucial time. We'll see then whether the great big U.S. stimulus package is actually working. We'll also see what's happening in China and whether there's a need for another stimulus there. What we most want is agreement between the U.S. and China about how the stimulus should happen and when. And the crucial time for that is going to be later in this year, when we really see how bad this recession is proving to be.
Well, Bill, certainly all the other world leaders are going to be watching this meeting because they're as interested in the outcome as anyone else in the world. It seems to me it's very, very clear that the U.S. needs China to lend money and to finance the various sort of stimulus programs that Barack Obama wants to finance here in Washington. But it's also the case that China wants U.S. exports or U.S. consumer demand to buy its exports. But China also has another demand, which the U.S. maybe isn't interested in, and that is getting perhaps away from the dollar as a reserve currency, suggesting this global currency idea that was floated a few days ago. What's the chance that that will come up either privately or publicly?
I think that that's unlikely to come up privately because, well, if I may put it this way, it's got about a snowball's chance in hell of actually happening. And so I don't think it's going to come up privately. It may be mentioned publicly by the Chinese because they are using this proposal to divert attention from issues like China's currency manipulation, its own huge trade surplus, and the fact that its currency is fixed and not able to float convertibly on world markets. And China wants to divert attention from that and point all the blame at the U.S. and at the dollar. So publicly, they may waive this proposal, but privately, it has no hope of getting anywhere, so I don't think they're going to waste time on it.
Bill, thanks so much for joining us. Bill Emmett is the former editor of The Economist.
Other news out of London at the meeting, President Obama says he has accepted Dmitry Medvedev's invitation to visit Moscow, and he's going to go in July. The president met with Medvedev early, and later on today, Hu Jintao he'll be meeting with as well. So if you're a protester and have descended on London for the G20 conference, what's on your sign?
Hello, my name is Vladimir from Las Vegas, and my comment would be, hands off the tax havens. They're a growth industry, and that's where I'm trying to start my next career.
Is that another listener in the crowd?
Good morning. This is Jim from Westchester. My placard, if I was protesting in London, would be one of celebration. Ding dong. Dick is gone.
Dick Cheney he's talking about? A little random. Send us your ideas for a placard for the G20 at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. As G20 leaders gather in London, the budget, the huge budget, is the focus for lawmakers on Capitol Hill this week. A big part of that debate is dealing with health care costs, of course. Democrats want to set aside more than $600 billion for health care, and that's just a down payment. The Republicans don't have much of a say, but they do have a plan. They say the Congress won't need to spend that amount of money if there's a focus on preventive health care. And with a way to force the Democrats to focus on preventive health care is Congressman David Dreyer from California. He has some power to change the rules of the House and do something that's never been done before. In an exclusive from our own Todd Zwillick from Capital News Connection. Todd, what's the story here?
Well, John, under an obscure rule in the House called the mandatory quorum, the minority party, and the Republicans are in the minority, they can compel the majority to meet specific procedural targets for lawmaking to proceed. It's not done very often. It doesn't stop the wheels of government, but it can slow them down. He wants to add something to the morning routine. Listen to this.
And what we're contemplating is every morning when the Congress convenes, moving from the prayer to the pledge to physical therapy. Physical activity is something that is important for members of Congress, and we're looking at a number of proposals. The idea of maybe light calisthenics before we begin the one-minute speeches in the morning.
So under House rules, he's serious? Making the House do jumping jacks, bench presses, that sort of thing?
He's dead serious. Dreyer says that the plan is radical. He acknowledges that. But he says that radical is exactly what's needed here. Look, the Institute of Medicine says that lack of exercise and a sedentary lifestyle cost the healthcare system about $350 billion a year in health costs and lost productivity.
Well, we reported on that here on The Takeaway, sure.
Absolutely. And there's just no way to get a handle on healthcare costs if something proactive isn't done. So far, no one, John, has found a formula to get the public off the sofa here. So Dreyer wants Congress to lead by example. He's dead serious about this. Also, keep in mind on the whole, you know, keeping in shape obesity thing, a lot of Democrats want to crack down on junk food in schools and junk food advertising, and those companies are major Republican donors. So the more the GOP can do to promote physical activity side of the equation, maybe it's better for their political base.
Almost a fundraising tool in addition to changing lifestyle. But is there any legal congressional precedent for this, Todd?
Well, there is. The mandatory quorum is rare, but there is a precedent. I looked it up. Back in 1958, during the Korean War, the Democrats who were in the minority under the administration of Dwight Eisenhower, they were able to compel Republicans to actually symbolically learn the Korean national anthem.
Really?
In exchange for proceeding on a vote. It was done in 1958. It was done quietly, and it took place only over about 10 minutes on the House floor. But they are allowed to set parameters for debate to move forward, and they used this. So Dreyer does have a historical precedent that he's using
here. He's got the wiggle room to actually do it based on history. So how would this work? Members of Congress would actually be expected to mandatorily gather on the floor of the House and be led how?
Group exercise en masse. That's the idea. Of course, the nature of the exercise is up for debate, John. Everything is up for debate in the Congress. Light calisthenics are a possibility. Jumping jacks, you mentioned. Knee bends. Anything is really a possibility.
Even Jerry Nadler?
Whatever he can do. In fact, Jerry Nadler, if he wants to participate, would be an ideal candidate. It's not so much the actual routine that's important. Dreyer and his allies, and he has a lot of powerful allies in this, say they just want Congress to be seen, preferably on camera, setting an example so that the public can follow along. Listen to part of this from my interview with Dreyer the other day.
I believe in globalization, and I think that we need to take advantage of the great ideas that emerge from other cultures. And in Japan, it is true. In the corporate world, as they begin their day, they engage in calisthenics. And so I think that the idea of bringing that concept to the United States Congress to set an example for the American people could have a lot of appeal.
Japan being an example for the GOP. This is hot stuff, Todd.
Believe it or not, well, Dreyer is a big champion of free trade. He calls himself a radical free trader. And in addition to that, what he wants is accountability here. I mean, what's the point unless there's some benefit?
Right.
So he's proposing something else. John, have you ever seen The Biggest Loser TV show?
I know of it, yes.
You know, okay, people get weighed and they try to lose weight. Dreyer's going a step towards that here. He's proposing to install fancy stand-up scales in the Democratic and Republican cloakrooms right off the House floor so that members who choose to can actually weigh in and chart their progress, believe it or not. He's not going so far as to make this a matter of public record, the results, but of course, members who choose to can release the information. Listen to this part of the interview.
We could possibly create sort of a partisan competition on this to see which side of the aisle is more successful at weight reduction. And so these are just some ideas that we're working on right now.
Well, I can see some pie charts on, Congress.gov. I can't imagine a bunch of congressmen, most likely out of shape, really allowing themselves to be filmed on the House floor each day. I mean, is this the C-SPAN image they're going to want?
Well, according to Dreyer, image is exactly what this whole thing is about. He says he predicts that when C-SPAN shows the morning pledge and the calisthenics folks at home on their couches will be motivated maybe to get up and join in. He says he fully expects the cable networks and the Foxes out there to make fun of it at first, but that after a while routinely picking up the video of the morning exercises may report on the weight loss that members of Congress are achieving.
You know, I can see how this would work because when I watch C-SPAN and there's like no one in the House, just one person talking, it motivates me to just sort of sit down and go to sleep.
Well, I think that's what they're going for. Maybe if people see them actually getting up off the sofa and doing something, doing just light exercise. This isn't about, getting on a treadmill, and hopefully it's not about looking too silly. It's about motivating people to get up out of their chair and get used to doing a little bit of physical activity. Believe it or not, there are hundreds of billions of dollars at stake.
And it's a parliamentary matter. It's under the rules. So the timing, explain that to me, Todd.
Well, if you look at the calendar, it's the beginning of April. It's April 1st. That might have something to do with it. It's tax season. Of course, it's budget week. So everyone's looking for savings. Healthcare is a huge ticket item. We've mentioned more than $300 billion. And if you can begin to get those costs under control, you can make a dent in this gigantic debate that Congress is having about the $3 trillion budget. It's all about prevention in the healthcare system. And Dreyer says he already has some bipartisan support for this in the context of the budget and health costs.
Physical activity, prevention. Healthcare savings. The GOP has a plan. Todd Zwillick has the story. Thanks so much, Todd.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection. To see some of the Takeaway staffers lead by example, go to thetakeaway.org. Now Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. 29 minutes after the hour, President Obama will go to Moscow in July. He just wrapped a meeting with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, who invited him to visit Russia. The meeting in London is ahead of the G20. It was their first face-to-face talk. The leaders say they want to cut a new arms deal before the current one ends in December. This is just one of an array of meetings for the president today. After a meeting with the UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown, the president stressed the economy is everyone's problem. He's also talking with Brown's main political rival, British Conservative Party leader David Cameron. Palestinian rival factions Fatah and Hamas are restarting their reconciliation talks in Egypt. Also an interesting development in the troubled relations between the U.S. and Iran. A U.S. special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrook, spoke briefly with the deputy foreign minister of Iran yesterday.
Thank you, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. If Wall Street traders were on the streets of London, the signs they might be carrying would be sell, sell, sell. Futures suggest a negative opening on Wall Street in about an hour. But protesters from all over the world are on the streets of London for the G20 summit. They have signs like, we won't pay for your crisis, put people first. What's on your sign? Give us a hell no, we won't go at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So we've been hearing about the gathering in London of world leaders ahead of the G20 summit tomorrow, trying to sort out the world's economic troubles. But does the world agree that the G20 countries are the only ones who should be given this kind of responsibility?
There's 29, you know, it's not just 20.
Really?
Yeah, we learned that yesterday from David Sanger.
All right, okay. Then that's very misleading. So anyway, what about the countries that haven't been included in that party of 20, 29, 170-plus countries or so? Well, our partners at the BBC have a listener-fueled show called World Have Your Say, and yesterday it reached out to its international listeners and asked them to respond. Ross Atkins is host of the BBC's World Have Your Say, and we had a chance to talk about his programme earlier this morning. And Ross started with the premise that some people got riled up about countries being left out. And when we spoke, I asked him how he came up with the number of 170 uninvited countries.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I didn't spend hours and hours coming up with this figure. We wanted to do a programme which focused on the countries which haven't been invited, as you were saying, and a cursory glance at a few different sources suggested that if you ask some people, they'll tell you it's 194 countries, other 195. There are some other different points of view as well, which come up with different figures. So I pretty much closed my eyes and went for one of them, deducted 20, and we came up with World Have Your Say's G174. It wasn't really a statement about which countries do exist and which countries don't. It was more an opportunity to say that if you're not within the G20, this program's for you. And so it proved. We got a fantastic response. You won't be surprised to hear we heard from a lot of Africans, but also contributors from Albania, from Venezuela, from Uruguay, and also from India.
Let's go to one of your listeners from Africa and have a listen into what they had to say.
My continent, the African continent, is seriously underrepresented. South Africa is the only country on the entire continent of 53 countries that was invited. But the voices of workers and the trade unions is missing at the table that is shaping the future of our world. And workers have paid in so many ways and continue to pay the price of the global economic crisis.
So what kind of feedback were you getting from the developing world, Ross?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I said just before that clip that we got people getting in touch from India. And the reason that happened was that even people who are within the G20 feel this is actually about the G4 or the G5. And it's only really America, the UK, France, Germany and a handful of other countries which can really have any sort of influence on what's decided. The main reaction from the developing world, well, I'd say there were two things. One was a very clear message. We heard this from Stephen in Lagos in Nigeria, who said, lots of people in the developed world think we're not ready to give a decent contribution. You think we're too corrupt. You think our businesses, our economies are not well structured enough. They're not efficient enough. And there was a strong message from a lot of listeners in especially West Africa saying, well, actually, we know we've had problems, but we are getting there. The second message was one of really indifference. I just got in this morning and had an email from a guy called Robert in Uganda who said, look, Roz, I appreciate the G20 is going on, but to be honest, I'm not paying any attention. I don't even want my president to pay attention. I want him to sort out the electricity, which isn't working in my house at the moment. So some people in the developing world are much more interested in day-to-day things and maybe aren't making the connection between what's happening a few miles away from me here in London and what's happening in their day-to-day lives.
So they say all politics is local, all economics apparently is local there. I'm wondering if the discourse that you're seeing on the show is emblematic of a really huge divide between these G20 countries and all of the wealth that they represent and the rest of the world that is pretty much on the outs. And can you get beyond, we have the money, you don't, pay attention, and we'll give you some news when it's time. But basically, you're not involved in this.
Well, I have to tell you, John, I mean, there's been much made of the fact that there hasn't really been a meeting of this many powerful leaders for some time. But I don't know if I've ever seen a meeting of so many cynical people on World Have Your Say as we've heard in the last few weeks. And I'm not just talking from the poorer countries in the world, from all countries, from your country. Our listeners in America are deeply, deeply cynical about what this whole process is going to do for them. But you are right. There is a sense that from a lot of our listeners that this was primarily a crisis created by America, regardless of what what Barack Obama or Gordon Brown might say. There is a sense that this was created by America and that actually what the G20 is trying to do is to get America and its wealthy allies out of trouble. There's a fury that just as this crisis is kicking in, the wealthiest countries in the world are turning to what people call protectionism. They're saying, hold on, the Doha trade talks fell apart because there was too much protectionism. The last thing we need is more protectionism, because otherwise poorer people from with weaker currencies and working within weaker economies cannot compete with farmers or, you know, industries within America and within Western Europe and beyond into India and China and Japan. So there is a fury that this is a problem which people see as having been created by the wealthy, and now the wealthy are deciding to fix it primarily with their own interests at heart.
You're pretty much giving your listeners a chance to just air and rant a little bit on their soapboxes. Let me just tune into one from Venezuela.
I will say that countries like Venezuela have a lot to say. Venezuela has been trying to move away from this kind of policies quite successfully, and has been not been invited to this meeting. And on the contrary, anything that has been done in Venezuela has been demonized.
Ross, just to wrap up, did you get any really great concrete suggestions from your listeners about really where we should be going with the world economic crisis?
OK, well, I'll give you two. One came from that gentleman, Jordi, who you just played. He's a Spanish guy speaking about Venezuela. And he and Ibrahim from South Africa both said it's time to put workers at the heart of how we organise the world economy. They say they want specific rules for how workers can be treated and also specific rules on the influence that workers had. A second idea came from Fatos in Albania, who said there's been much talk about placing morality back into the world economy. Kevin Rudd, the Australian Premier, said that yesterday. He was saying in the developing world, there are so many small businesses who deal directly with their communities who know the value of morality in business. And if only the richer countries of the world would listen to the lessons that have been learned in the developing world, it might be that much easier to get morality into our economic system.
And that was Ross Atkins, host of the BBC's A World Have Your Say, having his say on The Takeaway in an interview we did earlier on this morning. Now, the news is so fresh, Mark Garrison is still typing it. Mark.
Thank you. 21 minutes before the hour, the Justice Department wants all charges dropped against former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. He was convicted on corruption charges last year. The judge in the case at the time criticized the prosecution for failing to turn over some documents as ordered. The way it works from here is Justice would ask the judge to dismiss the original indictment. Once that happens, the actual conviction against Stevens would be vacated. Afghan President Hamid Karzai meets with Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari in Turkey today. They're discussing ways to combat Islamic terror in their countries. Militant activity in the border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan is high. That area believed to be a safe haven for Taliban and Al-Qaeda fighters. In Afghanistan today, Taliban militants in suicide vests attacked a local government office in Kandahar. Finally, back in the U.S., another of President Obama's cabinet picks has run into tax problems. Health Secretary nominee Kathleen Sebelius paid about $7,000 in back taxes. You'll remember the previous pick for the job, former Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle, pulled out after his tax problems came to light. Femi and John.
That's the condition, I think, of being nominated. You have to have tax problems. I mean, it's an experience in government. Thank you, Mark.
Cheers, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Femi O'Kay.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Fem?
So, you may not have heard about it because of the rising tensions between North Korea and Japan over whether Pyongyang is planning a missile launch test this weekend. But the communist nation is squaring off with another nation today. South Korea and North Korea are playing a World Cup qualifying game in Seoul, and it could be quite a strange spectacle. We're talking soccer here. John Sudworth is the BBC South Korea correspondent. Are you reporting live from the match, John?
I am, yes. I'm speaking to you from the stadium here in Seoul. The two teams have been on the pitch now for 80 minutes or so. You can hear the crowd in fine voice there. South Korea on another attack, but the score at the moment is still nil-nil, which I have to say rather disappointingly seems to be the run of things when these two teams meet. I think these occasions are always very tense. North Korea always defends pretty strongly, and at the moment it doesn't look like South Korea are going to come close to scoring.
John, quickly, are all the North Koreans in the audience dressed in the exact same outfits?
Well, you know what? There is not a North Korean in sight. And, of course, there's a very serious reason why that is the case. North Korea's travel restrictions that it places on its own people make it impossible for North Koreans to attend the match, even if they could afford to do so. So it's a pretty one-sided affair here in terms of where the support is coming from.
So when the North Koreans are playing well, what does the crowd sound like, John?
Well, I say it's a one-sided affair, but the other interesting thing about this is it doesn't really have the feel of an intense rivalry that you might expect between two old enemies like North and South Korea. Most of the spectators that we've spoken to, the South Koreans here, say that they feel a deep respect for their North Korean compatriots. There's obviously a serious difference between the two political systems, but the North Korean team does get a warm welcome. And in fact, in previous times these two teams have met, there have been a group of South Korean supporters who, out of a sense of patronage and charity, if you like, come together to cheer the North Korean team on. So, as I say, it doesn't really have that sense of intense rivalry, but nonetheless, I think because of the political backdrop at the moment, there's a heightened sense of drama because of that plan for a rocket launch that we've heard so much about the North Korea intends to go ahead with at some point in the next few days.
And which team is favourite to win?
Well, you know what, I think before this game, most people were saying that North Korea had been looking stronger. They're certainly ahead in the group at the moment. They lead South Korea by 2 points. But watching the action on the pitch tonight, it has pretty much all gone South Korea's way. Unfortunately, though, the only thing they haven't been able to do is score.
I hear the crowd going wild there in the background. How about getting tickets to this game? Tricky or not?
Well, it's a pretty full house, but looking around, there are a few seats. Again, football is a very, very popular sport in South Korea, but it is interesting. If this was the sort of derby that you might see in United Kingdom football between, say, Scotland and England, perhaps, it would, of course, be a full house. Here in South Korea, I think, again, because of the peculiar nature of these kind of occasions, perhaps the stakes aren't quite as high as they would be elsewhere.
OK, John Subworth, BBC correspondent in Seoul, South Korea, reporting on North Korea playing South Korea for the World Cup qualifying soccer.
0-0.
So far.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. The job of governing Pakistan, who'd want it? The story of the person that has that responsibility coming up right after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama is in the middle of a diplomatic whirlwind in London this morning, all this ahead of the G20 summit there. Already he's met with leaders from Britain and Russia. He'll sit down with Chinese President Hu Jintao in just a few minutes, just after a meeting with British Prime Minister Gordon Brown earlier this morning. The president said he expects disagreement.
I know that the G20 nations are appropriately pursuing their own approaches. And as Gordon indicated, we're not going to agree on every point. I came here to put forward our ideas, but I also came here to listen.
He does agree with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev on something. President Obama expected an invite to Moscow earlier this morning. That trip planned for July. The two men also agreed to work on a new arms deal. The current one is up in early December. The floodwaters are receding in North Dakota after a lashing from a blizzard. The Red River is still around 37 feet, but the levees holding back the river remain strong, and Fargo officials say businesses there can reopen today. Computer security specialists are trying to figure out what the latest change in the Conflicker computer virus will do to infected computers. Mark Shavlik is a security expert. He says the worm opens your computer to people you don't know.
It does have the ability, and this is on millions of computers all over the world, to do something on your computer based on the command of someone you don't know who they are, somewhere in the world, And that's why it's so scary.
Today is a significant day. Some new developments were to happen in the virus today, but analysts say that it will be several days before it's clear what happens today, what that actually means, and what it means for the computer users everywhere. Femi.
Thanks very much, Mark. I already mentioned the G20 meeting, some of the meetings happening before the G20 tomorrow. And today, protesters from all over the world are descending on London for that G20 conference. But you can't be in London, so tell us what you would write on your protest sign. What are you angry about? Make it catchy. Tell us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. John.
Well, in contrast to the very orderly protests we're seeing in London as G20 leaders gather to talk about the world economic crisis, the tumultuous protests last month led by opposition leader Nawaz Sharif in Pakistan raised the question of whether Pakistan is stable enough to proceed. Can Pakistan be governed? It's the question in the title of an article by our next guest, James Traub, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. The president of Pakistan, Asif Ali Zardari, is believed to be one of the least popular leaders in the South Asian region, yet he has one of the biggest responsibilities in maintaining security in one of the most unstable parts of the world. James Traub has a piece on this topic in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, delighted to be here, John.
You know, the question is, that is the whole question. It's a question not only just for Pakistan, but it's for the entire world. What are the challenges of governing Pakistan, and how were those expressed by President Zardari, who you spent some time with?
Yeah, the underlying question, I think, is, can Pakistan function as a democratic state? You know, for much of its history, Pakistan was governed by the military, and the military still takes the view they're the only ones who know what they're doing. The civilian politicians are a bunch of clowns. Yet what struck me when I was there, and I spent 2 weeks in Pakistan recently, is I think there's really a consensus that that model doesn't work. Pakistan is only going to work if it's a democracy. Only if Pakistan can provide real governance, real democratic values, as opposed to what, in effect, the Taliban is offering. Are they going to be able to succeed in getting people to coalesce around some kind of a vision of what Pakistan should be? So that's the underlying fact. It does have to be a democracy. There are real deep democratic impulses in Pakistan. Now, having said that, they have a specific government. They have this guy, Asif Ali Zardari. He's the head of the state. He's a very unimpressive person, I'm sorry to say.
And, you know, let's talk about regional issues. I mean, there are places like the Swat Valley in the northwest of Pakistan where the Taliban is perceived to be something of a relief from a sense of anarchy that's reigned for quite a long time. And the verdict, as you write in your story, of 8 years under President Musharraf, military leader, was not good. Clearly, the Pakistanis want a democratic alternative. But what's the model? Is it across the border in India, or is it something from within?
Well, of course, there's no real democratic model. Every country has their own democratic system. But at the same time, well, you can look at India perfectly well and see India is a much less likely country than Pakistan in terms of being able to function effectively. So many different language groups, religious groups, ethnic groups, and so forth. And yet for all of India's colossal problems, it is a place where everybody has a chance to use their voice. And so India doesn't, in fact, suffer from the possibility of state breakup. India is a functioning country and, of course, one of the fastest growing economies in the world. So that would be just fine if Pakistan could emulate that. I tend to think historically Pakistan's problem has been that it was born with such a profound fear of India and so organized itself around that fear of India that it became a kind of national security state. And only now, I think, is it becoming clear to everybody that model doesn't work.
Your impressions of Zardari, is he someone who understands, number one, his unpopularity and the fragility of his regime, or is he in a bubble?
You know, he talks as if he were in a bubble. My guess is he's a pretty shrewd guy, and he knows that he's not very popular, and he knows that politically he's in a really tight place. His instincts, though, are so zero-sum. The guy is a fighter. I mean, he's kind of a street fighter, and he's a clever street operative. But it seems to me he doesn't get the fact that he's engaged in a profoundly public activity. So I think this whole drama we saw that you referred to in the introduction, this huge demonstration led by Nawaz Sharif, I think Zardari thought, I can use this opportunity to really get this guy. I can destroy this guy. And so he tried to do that through various means. He basically succeeded in getting the government of Punjab, which Sharif controls, unseated. And he thought he would kind of strike a death blow at the guy before he struck a blow at Zardari. Well, it didn't work that way.
No.
He didn't understand that. In fact, there really was a groundswell of public support behind this demonstration, which in turn was demanding the reinstatement of the deposed Chief Justice. It was a public event, not some kind of little private knife fight between two political
right.
opponents.
And now Iftikhar Chowdhury, the Chief Justice, is reinstated. And is there a fight brewing between the judiciary in Pakistan and President Zardari? And what's the chances of Zardari surviving?
I don't think that's where the danger comes. And by the way, I don't think Zardari is immediately threatened. I think what happened to him in these recent events was he struck a real grievous blow at his own political standing. And I think almost everybody came out well from this big drama. The judiciary came out well. Sharif came out well. The army, whose intervention seemed wholly in order to defend democracy, came out well. Zardari came out badly.
You know, many on this program have suggested that Zardari in the early going has kind of fumbled in projecting much greater focus on Barack Obama and the so-called war on terror than in dealing with the much more near and dear to the people of Pakistan's hearts, the issues with India, you know, regional issues, Kashmir, etc. Do you sense that he's miscalculated in this way?
You know, he has a genuine problem here, which we have to be sympathetic to, which is to say, if Zardari were acting the way the United States would like to see him act in regard to extremism, he'd be hurting his popularity even more. And as it, because only now, I think, are the Pakistani people coming to recognize that extremism is their problem as much as it is ours. And the terrorist attack in Lahore that happened the day before yesterday, I think, is a terrifying wake-up call. But right now, the Pakistani people still tend to think the United States is making us do it. And in fact, they blame Zardari, who they see as a kind of American lackey. And so what Zardari has not been able to do is to publicly state the problem in a way so as to rally the Pakistani people themselves behind the need for a solution.
And that, of course, is the call from Barack Obama last Friday in outlining his policy, suggesting that Pakistan does need to be more of a player, more involved in dealing with the regional issues. So James Traub, contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine, his piece, Can Pakistan Be Governed?, appears in this Sunday's New York Times. We leave you with some remarks from Barack Obama talking about Pakistan last Friday.
And after years of mixed results, we will not and cannot provide a blank check. Pakistan must demonstrate its commitment to rooting out al-Qaeda and the violent extremists within its borders.
And we're also keeping an eye on London, where protesters from all over the world are gathering for the G20 conference. So if you want to join the protest, tell us what you'd write on your protest sign. Here's one that someone emailed into us earlier. Bonus caps or kneecaps? And call us with yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And from the protest, here's your takeaway.
Mostly thus far, it has been shouting, a bit of pushing and shoving, but so far, very little signs of violence. But we expect these demonstrations to go on for a long time. This is just the beginning.
That's the BBC's, our partners, Jack Izzard. And we also seem to be getting your attention with a story about the congressional calisthenics from Todd Zwillick.
I think it's a great idea for Congress to be exercising. I wish my work would do it every day at a time when people are overworked and stressed. Exercise can be a great way to start the day.
Excellent. You should definitely go to our website and check out our staff doing some exercising on this April the 1st. Go to thetakeaway.org. I'm Femi OK.
Congressional abs. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Filmmaker, artist, he's pop culture's authentic pink flamingo. Ladies and gentlemen.
Hi, I'm John Waters, and I'm looking for a date with you. Come on over. Let's listen to some tunes. Wow, you look great. Come on in. Would you like a drink? Have a seat on my sofa and let me play for you the first record I ever got. Tonight, you belong to me by patience and prudence. So pure, so good.
I know.
Oh, we have a date with John Waters this morning, curator of the good, the bad, and the beautiful, without a hint of hairspray.
Of course, I can be bad, too.
So bad. Cool Waters on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, April the 1st. I'm Femi Oke. Adora Udoji is away spending time with her new baby. Coming up this hour, we'll hear about the President Obama's meetings with world leaders in London. We'll also get the latest on the protests there and discuss a new study that examines the male biological clock.
What?
Yes, you're running out of time. Well, you're out of time, John.
we got some headlines first. Moscow, anyone? Barack Obama says he's in. He's accepted Russian President Dmitry Medvedev's invitation to visit the Russian capital in July during their meeting today in London. They also announced talks for a new nuclear arms deal. President Obama says they have common interests to pursue.
Both countries, I believe, have an interest in reducing nuclear stockpiles and promoting nuclear nonproliferation.
These are the first major arms talks in more than a decade. Medvedev is just one of the world leaders the president is meeting today. Also on the docket, meetings with Chinese President Hu Jintao. It should be beginning right about now. And Queen Elizabeth, Femi.
The Justice Department says it will drop all charges against the former Alaskan Senator Ted Stevens. Stevens was convicted last fall on corruption charges and lost his re-election bid in November. The Justice Department says that prosecutors withheld evidence from Stevens's defense team that could have been used at the trial. Adhesive manufacturer 3M announced today that it's cutting 1,200 jobs, or 1.5% of its workforce. And meanwhile, Japanese automaker Honda is planning to scale back its North American production. It's also reducing pay for its salaried employees and forcing hourly workers to take unpaid leave.
Israel's new conservative foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, says he opposes peace talks with the Palestinians and that making concessions will only invite war. The remarks came during a handover ceremony today. It's the new administration's first official day in office. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is in Turkey to meet with Pakistan President Asif Ali Zardari. The talks are aimed at increasing cooperation between the countries amid fighting to find cooperation on fighting militant violence that's taking place in both countries. The Dow and S&P went up more than 1% yesterday, but futures trading suggests when Wall Street opens in about 30 minutes, it's going to be a bounce downward. Protesters from all over the world are descending on London for the G20 conference. They've got signs that say, "Capitalists, you are the crisis." Put some words on a placard and call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Your slogan, your message for the G20.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
We've been checking in all morning with the gathering protesters in London the day before the G20. City of London Police Commissioner Mike Barron warned today that police were ready to deal with troublemakers in the capital's financial district.
I'm here to make sure that the city operates as a city, business as usual, with one or two adjustments, obviously. For people to protest quite lawfully, but if they overstep that mark and break the law, they'll be dealt with firmly. No ifs, no buts.
So we go now to the BBC reporter Jack Izzard. We've been checking in with you, Jack, all morning. A few more things are beginning to happen. Tell me what.
Yeah, we are now reaching full speed, if you like, with these demonstrations. There are now three separate demonstrations going on across London. Now, I'm in the City of London. That's the heart of the financial district. You can possibly hear the crowd behind me now. Very sizable crowd here, several thousand people. Thus far, pretty good spirits. Lots of singing, lots of chanting. There's been a fair bit of shoving, though, at the police lines, which are, I guess, about 50 yards from where I am now. Maybe you can hear the whistling going on behind me. This is an anti-capitalist and anarchist demonstration. These are people who say that capitalists are the problem, not the cause. They want to abolish the capitalist system and replace it with something else. Just a few hundred yards away, we've got environmentalist campaigners. There has been a fair bit of missile throwing going on there. The headquarters of the Royal Bank of Scotland, one of Britain's major banks and one of the banks that has suffered worse in the credit crunch, it's now been bailed out by the British taxpayer and is 85% state-owned. That headquarters has been smashed, and people have written thieves on the wall in big blue letters. Across town in the last few minutes, a third major demonstration has started. That's an anti-war demonstration. Right now it's outside the US embassy. Demonstrators there are calling for UK troops to pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Jack, just to clear this up, when you say missiles, you mean objects are being thrown in the crowd, not actual missiles.
Yeah. No, we're not talking about guided missiles. We're talking about rocks and bottles and that kind of thing. So it is looking a bit touchy at times. You can possibly hear the crowd behind me now. This has very much been the theme of the day. Lots of shouting, lots of excitement. There has been a fair bit of pushing and shoving on the police lines. But for now, the police tactics, I would say, are fairly relaxed. It's always a good indication to gauge the mood of these things by to look at what the police are wearing. Of course, at the moment, the police are wearing their normal uniforms. No sign of riot shields, riot helmets and batons, that kind of thing. If you see them starting to wear those things, an indication perhaps that things are going to take a turn for worse. But for now, no evidence of that.
Jack, thank you very much. That's Jack Izzard, our BBC reporter, our BBC partner there, reporting live from London from the protests about the G20 summit.
Well, plenty of developments and activity out on the streets of London, but behind closed doors, world leaders are getting together, and there's a lot of focus on who Barack Obama is meeting with. He met with Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, earlier this morning. Later on today, Hu Jintao of China and also Queen Elizabeth, but just concluded a meeting between President Barack Obama and Dmitry Medvedev, the president of Russia. And out of that, some news already. The announcement that the president will be going to Moscow in July, answering an invitation from President Medvedev, and also some discussions on a U.S.-Russian treaty, potential arms control treaty that could slash American and Russian strategic nuclear arsenals by about a third and possibly even more, the first such treaty in a long time. Joining us from Moscow is Moscow Bureau Chief for our partner, the New York Times, Clifford Levy. Clifford, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, this is with all the talk leading up to the inauguration about anti-missile systems in Europe and deployment of systems in Poland, et cetera, and all the tension about that, a strategic nuclear arms treaty and set of negotiations is a whole new initiative. Would you agree?
It is. I mean, to some extent, this is one of the easier paths that they're trying to take. They're trying to push aside some of the more contentious ones, like, for example, that anti-missile system or the expansion of NATO into some of the former Soviet countries or Afghanistan. Both sides do want to attain some sort of reduction in these nuclear warheads. And so, to some extent, it's kind of a confidence-building measure to pursue this first.
You know, we certainly remember strategic arms talks from the Cold War era. A lot of people in the world are inclined to view this headline with a certain amount of head-scratching. Hey, wait a minute, I thought that was taken care of. What's the level of strategic nuclear missiles, and how much of a threat are they to each nation here?
Well, I mean, currently, under various treaties, they're allowed more than 2,000, and they're trying to get them down to perhaps 15,000 warheads apiece. And they do exist here, and they do exist in the United States. I mean, there are not a lot of people who think that each country is seriously threatening each other, but they are here, and they are kind of a legacy of the Cold War.
It's an interesting kind of reversal, Clifford, though. I mean, during the Cold War, the issue was all about the nuclear warheads, but now there's something of a bargaining chip, a stack of chips on both sides. These are the easy things to negotiate. The difficult stuff like oil and relations with Georgia and some of the other former breakaway republics, those are the hard things.
Yeah, I mean, it is something of a turnabout when you compare it to what happened in the old days when, obviously, these talks between the Soviet Union and Washington and the United States were often revolved around these issues. And as you say, it is somewhat of an easier path now. The anti-missile system that the Bush administration wanted to put in Poland and the Czech Republic is far, far more contentious. And I think people are really looking forward to that more than almost anything else, to see where the future of relations between the Kremlin and the White House are going to go.
Now, Clifford, George W. Bush famously described his relationship with Vladimir Putin as being a close one. He could look the man in the eye, even called him Pootie at a certain point. I suspect the chemistry between Barack Obama and Medvedev is going to be fundamentally different. Any assessment?
Well, I mean, there's been a great deal of anticipation in Moscow about this meeting. And there are some people here who say that they expect the two men may get along fairly well. They're both relatively young. They're both lawyers. They both, to some extent, tend to look at things with a legal bent. And they hope that that will allow them to build up some sort of relationship. You know, I think what's going on now is a bit like a first date. Both sides are kind of looking for all sorts of signals and suggestions and hints. You know, they're trying to get a sense of whether there's a real future to this relationship, whether they can move past the kind of sourness that existed at the end of the Bush administration.
Do you think the issue of Georgia will come up in these talks, and the issue of the anti-missile treaty deployment that was talked about during the transition and during the latter part of the campaign?
I think it will definitely be discussed. How deeply they'll get into it, it's difficult to say. The anti-missile system is a primary concern for the Kremlin. It's repeatedly voiced by both Mr. Medvedev and Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. It is something that they're intensely focused on. Georgia is also an issue, although it's faded somewhat. Things are kind of frozen in place right now in terms of Russia's relations with Georgia, Russia's relations with the two breakaway Georgian republics. You know, there are protests that are coming up in Georgia this week that the Kremlin and the White House will be looking at relatively closely. But in terms of relations between the U.S. and Russia, it's not so much Georgia itself as what's happening with NATO expanding into the former Soviet
right.
Union. And that means both Georgia and Ukraine.
Finally, you know, there's a lot of speculation around the world that Putin is really still running the show in Moscow. What Barack Obama to do here? Is he to try to have a meeting with Putin or to maintain a relationship with Medvedev, knowing that Putin is sort of behind the scenes? It seems like a tough challenge for the American president and that Putin, in a certain sense, even if we don't know what's exactly going on, has a bit of the upper hand.
You know, this is something that American diplomats are constantly discussing and constantly puzzling over. On a purely diplomatic level, it's not really appropriate for President Obama to have a relationship with Prime Minister Putin. It's done on a president-to-president level. You know, behind the scenes, obviously different things happen. And I think the American government still considers Prime Minister Putin, and Russians as well, consider Prime Minister Putin to be the paramount Russian leader, to be the paramount power here. However, when it comes to former relations between the two countries, it's president to president and nothing else.
Clifford Levy, Moscow bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Moscow about the meeting today between Barack Obama and Dmitry Medvedev, president of Russia. The president will be going to Moscow in July. Femi?
Protesters from all over the world are in London for the G20 conference. But if you can't afford the airfare to get there, tell us what you would put on your protest sign. Here's what Lees would say.
Slogans of the G20 protest might be speed, need, not greed.
Very catchy. Tell us what you'd write at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. John, what would yours say?
Deliver what placard? It would probably be unprintable. Be something.
Yeah, expletive, deletive, star,
yeah.
hash.
Show me the money or something.
Exclamation
like that.
Mark, and then all over again. On a good day.
Not that that's a bad thing.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. No April fooling in London as leaders from all over the world are gathered for the G20 summit. There are protesters all over the streets of London. If you can't make it to the protest, what would be on your protest sign? Keith probably is glad he's not there. If he put his sign in the middle of that crowd, he might get torn to pieces. America is going galt. Rest of the world, deal with it. Referring to the very, very independent and slightly arrogant Ayn Rand character from Atlas Shrugged, John Galt. Tell us what you'd write, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Our literary listeners, very literary.
Excellent. So let me take you back to the movies, to 1995 with a movie called My Cousin Vinny.
We agreed to get married as soon as you won your first case. Meanwhile, 10 years later, my niece, the daughter of my sister, is getting married. My biological clock is ticking like this, and the way this case is going, I ain't never getting married.
Marissa Tomei playing the character of Lisa in My Cousin Vinny.
Is she on the show?
I wish. Hello. She made her point loud and clear, though, to Vinny, but maybe he should have been worried about his own biological clock, John.
Men have biological clocks?
Just listen to this next segment. Lisa Belkin writes for the New York Times magazine. She makes the case in this week's Sunday magazine that there's now even more evidence that when it comes to making babies, men have a sell-by date. Hi there, Lisa.
Good morning.
So, let's talk facts here. In terms of old, how old is too old if you're a man and you want to make a baby?
Well, it's about the same age, very interestingly, as too old for a woman. I mean, the numbers, I'll rattle them off for you. The risk of conceiving for men, the chances of conceiving for a man begins to fall at 35. The chances of having a baby with schizophrenia begins to increase for men at 30. The chances for bipolar disorder in a child increases when the father is 29. It's highest over 55. And autism, there's an increased risk between 30 and 40, a decisive increased risk when the father is, you know, goes from 30 to 40. So men get old too, ain't it great?
So Lisa, where are you?
You guys.
You seem smart here. But Lisa, where are you getting your information from? Are these real studies in
these
terms of...
These are all real studies from various medical centers around the world. This is not an internet poll. This is real research.
So the impact of this information in terms of that guys can be too old to have babies, or if they have babies, then their babies may have issues and problems. What do you sort of bring, what conclusion do you make with that information?
Now, let's say one thing. The rate of risk is not huge. It's not like on your 31st birthday, suddenly you have 10 times the chance of having a child who's affected with autism. It's incremental, but it's real. And Lord knows parents do all sorts of things to prevent, you know, minuscule incremental risk to their children. So the question is whether or not this takes, if you will, whether or not men start to think of it the way women have been thinking of risk forever. Now, the risk they're thinking of is, can I get pregnant? That's the largest risk. And then there's Down syndrome that increases with age. But they are, women think in terms of that, you know, Marissa Tomei ticking clock. And if this takes, if this becomes part of the male psyche, and Lord knows there are a lot of women out there who would love to see that happen, then we might be a little closer to men understanding what it is that women have been harping on them about for years.
Lisa, aside from the sort of battle of the sexes issue that you raised there so tactfully, what is actually going on here? I mean, the mechanism for a reduction in the likelihood of conception on the part of women over the age of 33 relates in part to issues with the wall of the eggs and a toughening up that makes fertilization maybe less likely. But what's going on with men here? I mean, if you'll pardon the expression, isn't a sperm a sperm?
A sperm is a sperm, and it's a new sperm as opposed to an old egg. You're born with all your eggs. You make new sperm. But just like our body gets worse at making every other cell that it replicates, it seems that in the simplest way of describing it, we get
tired. Male bodies get tired. They're not as good at it. There is more of a chance as time goes on for genetic screw-ups. And that is the operating theory as to why this is happening.
So, Lisa, I found online as a 90-year-old farmer from India. He has 21 children, and his last baby had about 2 years ago. Now, these children look great. Now, surely if nature hadn't intended men to father babies, they would have stopped at around about 45.
I'm not going to get into what nature intended. Clearly, men can physically have children later than women can. We know that. What's interesting is the idea that it's not a get-out-of-jail-free card. It's not a as long as you want, and there'll be no difference whatsoever. Now, one could argue it probably never should have been in the first place, that there is a price paid to a child having an older father, that there's a price paid by society to men not being around as long to raise their children. And that, again, is a whole other conversation. But, yes, of course, you know, men can physically have kids longer. But if you start to drill down, they're finding really interesting things about how it's not absolutely the same to father a child at 20 as to father a child at 40 or 50.
Ah, she started a debate. Thank you, Lisa. Lisa Belkin's
article. She was positively gleeful.
Well, because you're a man of a certain age, don't be sensitive. Read the New York Times magazine this weekend.
Right, yeah.
It's called Your Old Man. Now time for some headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 28 minutes after the hour, President Obama is keeping busy in London with many world leaders' meetings. He's also beefing up his travel calendar. This hour, the president is meeting with Chinese President Hu Jintao. The White House just announced the president will visit China later this year. After meeting with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev, he announced a coming trip to Russia. The president stresses that the world's economies are linked.
We can't create jobs at home if we're not doing our part to support strong and stable markets around the world.
That was just after the president met with UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown. The Justice Department wants all charges dropped against former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. Stevens was convicted on corruption charges last year. The judge in the case criticized the prosecution for failing to turn over some documents as ordered. The way it works from here is the Justice Department asks the judge to dismiss the original indictment. Once that happens, the existing conviction against Stevens is vacated.
And then he becomes a senator again, right?
Maybe not. He lost his reelection, so he can't redo that one for a few years, but he could run again if he wants to. But
so it's kind of a judicial bridge
still
to nowhere.
Tough. Yeah.
Kind of, I see.
Yeah. if you will. Speaking of the Senate, the President Obama's second choice for Health Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has had her confirmation hearings yesterday and also tomorrow. She recently corrected 3 years of tax returns after finding what she called unintentional errors. She paid about $7,000 in back taxes. Former Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle, you recall, up for that job but pulled out with the same kind of tax problems.
This just in, AP reporting, the White House says Barack Obama going to China in the second half of 2009. Must have been a good meeting.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
They've got to go luggage shopping. They've got it. Look, today, yes. All right, Barack Obama already announces he's going to Russia.
Excellent.
Medvedev invited him. Hu Jintao now invites him to China. He's going to China late in this year, 2009.
I'll carry the luggage.
He's just a traveling president.
Yeah, he's got
very
things
popular
to do.
Guy.
People to meet.
Marcus Mabry said his popularity is huge, and he's demonstrating it in meetings. So we're talking about the G20 and the summit, and we want your slogan on a placard, 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org, your message for the G20. The popular president, Barack Obama began a transformation of the U.S. relationship with the Muslim world on Inauguration Day.
To those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist.
Talking to Islamic extremists in that reference in his inauguration speech, the president went on later on as his administration took hold to refer specifically to Iran as the Islamic Republic of Iran and to say that members of the Muslim world are actually partners for peace. Emil Nakhleh joins us. He's a former senior intelligence officer and director of the Political Islam Strategy Analysis Program in the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence. He's the author of the book A Necessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. He joins us from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Emil, thanks for being a part of the program. And from your perspective, inside the Muslim world, how do these transformational moments of Barack Obama really look?
They have resonated indeed very well in the Muslim world, as we have seen in media reports and public opinion polls. The president is doing, and which is resonating positively in the Muslim world, is to separate the so-called 2%, 1 to 2% of radicals and militants and extremists from the 98% of the rest of the Muslim world, and is trying to engage the rest of the Muslim world, and this is what is resonating. Significantly different from the previous few years, where we had painted the entire Muslim world with one broad brush of terrorism, thereby giving the impression that fighting terrorism became a war against Islam.
So you were in the CIA from 1991 to 2006, at least focused very specifically on these issues. You describe this separation of 98% of Muslim citizens who aren't extremists and the 2% who get characterized as terrorist or at least activist. Separation is one thing. But you also write repeatedly that the 98% need to be more politically involved and politically engaged in their nations to provide an effective counterweight. First of all, why is that the case? What are the challenges to getting the sort of non-militant Muslims in the world more politically engaged? And is the Obama administration tackling this?
Well, these are three very important questions. The first is that participating in government, having the right to vote, to have a say in their government, gives them more of a sense of proprietorship for the success of their states. Whereas now, unfortunately, in many of these Muslim countries, there are authoritarian regimes, and power is focused and is centered in the person of the executive, and there are no free political parties, free media, and so on. So participating in government becomes almost a source of stability in the long run in those countries. Now, the second point, the challenges, of course, are very significant in that the challenge is basically how do you engage the Muslim societies while at the same time cooperating with their regimes in the fight, let's say, against terrorism, criminality, corruption, and things of that sort. This is a very major challenge. What the Obama administration is doing, I think, is to already indicate that truly there is in their mind a separation between terrorism and the rest of the Islamic world, and that, two, they are very much interested in reaching out to the Islamic world because it's a question, they view it as a question of national security and national interest. And such an engagement in the long run would contribute to regional stability, whether in the Middle East or in South Asia.
Emil, this is Femi here. Were you actively, when you were in the field, trying to persuade individuals or groups, or just reporting back on your analysis to the CIA?
No, I was basically reporting back on our analysis and our interviews in the field. When we were convinced of two basic facts about our work. One, that we were only one voice that the administration listened to. They listened to many other voices. And oftentimes they accepted our analysis, and sometimes they didn't. And that, too, we did not really make policy. We were not suggesting specific policies. We were suggesting and briefing on approaches and initiatives that would resonate positively in the field based on our interviews and our analysis of public opinion polls and meetings with Islamic activists in so many Muslim countries.
Emil Nakhle, before we go, is it possible after 8 years of George W. Bush to make a democratic argument to the Muslim world without projecting the kind of regime change rhetoric that I think people in the Muslim world equated democratic changes as a sort of an American call for regime change?
Yes, it is possible. In fact, this was the kind of the problem that a number of those Muslim countries they faced. They saw the call for democracy and equated that with regime change. I think we need to engage credible Islamic groups in those Muslim countries, including Islamic political parties, that would in turn get the political process going in those countries without the fear of being imposed on them by the outside.
A complicated challenge and mission, and Barack Obama has embarked on it. Emil Nakhle is a former senior intelligence officer in the CIA from 1991 to 2006, the author of Unnecessary Engagement, Reinventing America's Relations with the Muslim World. Mr. Nakhle, thanks so much, and Mark Garrison now with headlines.
Thanks, John. Coming up on 20 minutes before the hour, more than a dozen are dead in Afghanistan after militants attacked a government office in Kandahar today. In neighboring Pakistan, a suspected U.S. drone fired on an alleged Taliban hideout of a leader who yesterday claimed responsibility for an attack on a police academy in Pakistan. Meanwhile, Afghan President Hamid Karzai and Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari met in Turkey today. They're talking about how to cut down on the kind of violence in the news this morning. The region around the neighboring country's border is a hotbed for militant activity. Finally, the floodwaters are receding in North Dakota and the blizzard is moving on. Right now, the Red River is around 37 feet. The levees are holding. The new worry is that some of the snow could melt and raise the water. Temperatures are warming up. John.
All right. Those people of Fargo. Got to admire them.
Great
well
folks.
Done. Well done. Thank you, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi Okay. So, even the best finishing school, John, will probably not prepare you for tea with the Queen. And that's exactly where the Obamas are heading today.
Definitely.
To Buckingham Palace. So President Obama will become the 11th U.S. president to have an audience with the Queen. Joining us on the line right now is Ingrid Seward. She's the editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine. Thank you very much, Ingrid, for joining us. Let's get some etiquette out of the way first of all. Should the Obamas take a gift to the Queen in a couple of hours' time?
Well, I don't think that there's any necessity for them to do that. On state visits, it's when there's a great performance about the exchange of gifts. But on a very short private visit, which is really to strengthen the bond between the UK and the USA, and the Queen is uniquely placed to do that, I think it would probably be completely unnecessary and out of place.
Now, what sort of advice would be given to the President and the First Lady in terms of their meeting this afternoon? It's going to be about 30 minutes at Buckingham Palace.
Well, it will be nerve-wracking for them because, you know, it's with great ceremony. They go through the garden entrance into the Queen's private area of Buckingham Palace, and they see her in her private audience room, which is where she meets our Prime Minister. They will be introduced by her private secretary, you know, Mr. President, this is Her Majesty the Queen. He will say, good afternoon, Your Majesty, and then he will then address her as ma'am. Mm. And they will shake hands. He'll not be expected to bow, and Michelle certainly won't be expected to curtsy.
Now, Ingrid, it is unlikely that the Queen would actually use profanity in saying to Barack Obama, thanks for ruining the banking system in the world financial system, correct?
Oh, absolutely. She won't discuss anything of any political nature. But she will make it. She will make him aware that she is conscious of the enormous weight of responsibility that he has on his shoulders. I think she will be extremely sort of gentle and welcoming, because she'll know it's nerve-wracking for them.
How orchestrated is this 30 minutes, Ingrid?
Fairly orchestrated, because of the time. It's a very short time. They've got to arrive, be taken up to the audience room, come in, shake hands. She will ask them to be seated. I don't suppose they'll even have a cup of tea. I don't know that there'll even be time for that. And they will exchange pleasantries, and there'll be, oh, of course, there'll be the photographs and the TV, which we will all see. Then the TV, the cameras leave the room, and leaving the Queen alone with the President and Michelle. I think she'll remain there. There's not a great deal of time to say anything.
Ingrid, we're going to be watching the Queen's body language as we see these pictures. How can we tell? You know her better than we do. How can we tell if she's enjoying the meeting or not?
You can't tell with the Queen. She never gives away a flicker of emotion, unless there's a sort of great joke. I mean, I'm sure she'll be laughing. She'll be wearing probably a bright coloured frock, probably carrying her handbag over her arm, because that's her sort of security blanket.
All right. Thank you, Ingrid. We'll have to wait and see how that all works out. Ingrid Seward, she's the editor-in-chief of Majesty magazine. Thanks, Ingrid.
Bright colored frock.
That's a dress in American.
A bright colored frock. That's yes. My takeaway.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, Cool Waters. John Waters, that is, coming up right after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, President Barack Obama is in a diplomatic whirlwind this morning ahead of the G20 summit in London. Already he's met with leaders from the UK, China, and Russia, and promised to visit China and Moscow this year. He and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev say they want new talks on reducing nuclear arms. These would be the first such talks in more than a decade. President Obama says nukes must be kept in safe hands.
The presence of these deadly weapons, their proliferation, the possibility of them finding their way into the hands of terrorists continues to be the gravest threat to humanity.
The president will be at a working dinner tonight with other G20 leaders. John.
Thank you, Mark. So, I am so thrilled and excited to have John Waters right here in the studio. From the movie Pink Flamingos to Hairspray and a million titles and moments in between, John Waters is a piece of Americana like no other. Film director, of course, but you have an art show that's opening here in New York at the Marianne Boesky Gallery from April 3rd to May 2nd. It's called Rear Projection. John Waters, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I've always thought of you as a collector and a curator of the sort of wonderful, ugly absurdities about America. When did you start your collection?
Well, right when I was a little kid, I always was interested in the wrong thing, and I didn't care. And I bought a little Miro portrait at the Baltimore Museum when I was young and took it home when I was 7. All the other kids went, oh, that's ugly. I hate that. Why would you have that? And then I realized the power of collecting art. So because I realized how angry it made people, and it excited me.
You know, the characters and the pieces in your visual art are not unlike your films in the sense that they're unusual, they're eccentric, but the thing that amazes me about all of your work, and I think it's true here in this visual art as well, there's a celebration about it. There's nothing alienated and kind of complaining and, oh, everybody teased me. Why is that? How do you maintain that?
Because I've had a great life. What do I? Anybody that's 63 years old and bitter is really no fun to be around. It's fun to be 20 and crazy. At 63, it's kind of disappointing. So I look up to what I make fun of. Everything I celebrate maybe is what other people try to hide, but I don't think I'm better than that. I think people with bad taste are more freer than I am. I care.
Now, there's a social critique in some of your work. There's a series of portraits of cleft palate and hair lip deformities on celebrities that is bizarre to look at, especially the Tom Cruise one is a crazy image. But you are making a point here. And explain.
I'm making the point that, you know, I certainly believe that the smile train, I am parroting that campaign that is all over America with, to me, a suspiciously high budget. There are billboards of these kids. I get them in the mail every day. And I believe, I hope all the kids get all the money, and I'm sure they do. But they are stars, too. They have made them stars. So I am parroting that campaign by putting those unfortunate birth defects on movie stars and imagining what mixing two kind of stars together and showing. It's still an ad campaign. It's still stars, and it's still trying to get your money.
And it also is a commentary on the power of celebrity. You know, we think of perfect pictures of celebrities as almost invisible. Okay, maybe we see Tom Cruise on the cover of a magazine, but to see it in the way that you project, it really it gets more attention than Tom Cruise would get walking down the street, I would think.
Well, everybody that you see has been retouched. I mean, certainly every photograph from a movie, and I believe that people remember not movies they saw, they remember the movie stills or the poster. And that's why what I tried to do was take all these images from movies and rearrange them in storyboards and come up with a new narrative, my own movies using other people's images.
I've always wanted to ask you this. Do you have a favorite decade?
You know, I always think tomorrow is going to be the favorite decade. I don't look back. I went through the insane 60s. I thought the 50s were terrible. That's when you had to be like everybody else. The 60s is when we rebelled and good things happened and bad things happened. But I always think the best is going to be tomorrow. I don't look back and say it was more fun when I was young.
But I mean, you are a nice guy and you're certainly happy. But you're looking back at the kind of Rita Hayworth pictures of the Hollywood 40s is not nostalgic.
No, because to me, I always liked the second one. Because I like Jane Mansfield better than Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I always liked the one that people liked a little less, more, because they were more extreme usually.
Now, John Waters in a pilgrim outfit. Explain.
That is, I live in Provincetown, Massachusetts in the summer, and we have a town crier that walks up and down the street every day, and I've been fascinated by him for 40 years. So I said to him, can I borrow your outfit? And it was so depressing. I had to go over, get in his outfit, and take a picture of myself. I was so mortified in that outfit. I never made eye contact with one human being on the street. It was an exercise in mortification.
But such courage.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I you did five things that I wouldn't have done, you know, at gunpoint. And you didn't make eye contact.
Well, when I got out of the car, I heard someone said, is that John Waters? And the person said, no, it's a lookalike. Because I was too embarrassed in the outfit. The only person that saw me was my landlady when I walked across the lawn and she was gardening and she looked up and saw me dressed as the town crier with no warning. And she just said, oh, hi. She didn't know what to say.
Yeah, well, I share her speechlessness. So on the streets of Baltimore, out of a pilgrim outfit, are you recognized?
Yeah, more in New York, I think. People are used to me in Baltimore. Yeah, people say great stuff to me. I think Matthew Marks, the art dealer, said I have the best kind of fame there is. Only the people that I would want to recognize do. It's not like I can't go out. And the people that come over to me say nice stuff. I don't get hassled.
Right. Are you a fan of The Wire?
Yes. Are you kidding? Really? Everyone, Pat Moran, who did all my casting for my movies, Vince Perenio did the production design, all the crew worked on my movies. I think it's one of the best shows since Pee-wee's Playhouse ever on television.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, The Wire, it seems to supplant the kind of eccentricity and fabulous sort of smiley-faced weirdness that is the John Waters aesthetic with a kind of a grim sort of...
Well, it's true. The Wire, you know, the governor hates The Wire. You know, he really hated the show, thought it made Baltimore look bad. And I told him, I've seen maps in Japan that people have of the worst corner in Baltimore. There, you know, not everybody likes tall ships. I hate the tall ships in Baltimore.
Right, right. So as a curator of this exhibit and this art exhibit called Rear Projection. Why Rear Projection, by the way?
Well, Rear Projection is a term that, as you know, when you see two people in a movie driving in a car and you can tell there's a movie behind them,
right,
when they shoot it.
Right.
But I took rear projection shots and put real rear ends also in the back. And then I shot movies on people's rear ends. So I was trying to interpret that cinematic expression in many different ways.
With the common theme of rear.
Yes.
What do you hope people take away from this exhibit? And when you observe people watching your art and experiencing your art versus your movies, what's that like?
What do I hope people take away from? I guess a beast.
Right. Yeah, right. You might have to buy. Buy.
I'm kidding.
Hey, I'm 63. Buy now.
But certainly,
it's a recession, folks.
I think that all my work, no matter whether it's books, movies, or anything, is about humor, about insider humor, about the business. And I try to celebrate the sadness regular people have for not being in show business.
That's interesting. That you celebrate the sadness people have for
regular people that aren't in it. I feel they must feel when they wake up every day a little depressed when they look in the mirror that they are not in show business.
Well, in the YouTube era, is it possible there's hope for the people who aren't in show business?
Sure, yeah, because everybody is. And you can just put your most embarrassing moments on 2 seconds, and then an advertising agency will call and offer you a job if enough people look at it.
So any more movies?
Well, I have a movie called Fruitcake. It's a terribly wonderful children's Christmas adventure, but it's fallen through twice in this economy. I'm hoping to make it. It's about a happy family of meat thieves. In Baltimore, we have that. They knock on your door and say, you take an order. I have 3 steaks, 2 pounds of ground beef, and then they deliver it shoplifted, and you pay half what's on the price.
Oh, you know, more. Baltimore is an endless reservoir of American culture. John Waters, a visual artist, filmmaker, and writer. His show, Rear Projection, is on view at the Marianne Boesky Gallery right here in New York from April 3rd to May 2nd, and in Los Angeles at the Gagosian Gallery from April 10th to May 23rd. John Waters, thanks so much for being
here. Thanks for having me.
So we're keeping an eye on the G20 conference in London, which starts tomorrow. But the protesters are already there today. Now, if you wanted to join the protests, what would you write on your sign? Give us your best protest slogan for the G20 at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE.
Oh, wait. Do you have a slogan? What would you put on your sign? John Waters?
About the Queen?
G20.
What's in that bag?
Nice.
I heard it's empty.
Don't ask that. It's a corgi. Okay, or my take at thetakeaway.org. And if you missed any of our coverage on the meeting, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. And before all the world leaders gather, U.S. President Obama is meeting with Russian President Dmitry Medvedev. So here's your takeaway.
What's going on now is a bit like a first date. Both sides are kind of looking for all sorts of signals and suggestions and hints. You know, they're trying to get a sense of whether there's a real future to this relationship.
That's New York Times Moscow Bureau Chief Cliff Levy.
And in reality, I've got one last question for you, John Waters. We'll save it for the website, takeaway.org. Go there. You'll see the video of the interview, and we'll put up a video of your last answer for the web only. Also, some of the John Waters artwork from Rear Projection will be online, too. Oh, one more protest slogan.
Hi, this is Jason Cox from Florence, South Carolina. My new protest slogan is, "Feel me okay, vacation, no more, no way, no how."
Whoa. One day co-hosting.
Hello, bro.
You're already a hit with listeners.
Oh.
This is John from New York in the control room at the Takeaway. Does anybody have Femi OK's email address? Thank you.
How did
April
you do that?
Fool.
That's magic.
We are so magical here at the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Femi OK. This is the Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway,